Welcome to Worldview from WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. The Mueller investigation appears about to wrap up and deliver a report to the Attorney General. Most reports expect the Mueller report to be delivered next week. Let's talk about the parameters of what's about to unfold with Yoni Applebaum from The Atlantic. He wrote the impeach cover story for the March issue. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, nice to be with you.
I wanted to start with just the way Robert Mueller has gone about his business here and what we can glean from that. We've had lots of indictments, lots of guilty pleas, but really this report, people really don't know what it's going to be like. They don't know what's in it. They don't know exactly when it's going to come. He's run a really tight ship.
Yeah, Mueller has shown the deafening power of silence. He has made remarkably few public statements through his spokesperson. He's mostly allowed this really remarkable series of indictments to speak for his investigation. And it's not wholly clear what form any report that he files will ultimately take. We do know a couple things about it. One is that under Department of Justice guidelines, a prosecutor cannot indict a sitting president. So for those listeners who are holding their breath and waiting for that, that is not in the cards. A second thing we know is that he is, at a minimum, supposed to tell the attorney general why he chose to file charges against those who he has charged and why he chose not to file charges in other cases. So he'll have to give something to summarize his activities to Bill Barr, the new attorney general. Beyond that, he has a range of options, and one which would be consistent with his conduct so far would be basically to summarize what he's done and leave it at that. At the other end of the spectrum, you could imagine Robert Mueller filing a report that said that he believes that the president has committed crimes which he is not in a position to indict. So anything between those two poles is possible.
Now, one of the things that's interesting here is to play out what is going to happen in the next week or so. We're going to see someone like Michael Cohen come before Congress now and start talking about this. And a lot of things are going to begin unfolding in Congress that are going to, possibly lead to more action. Can you talk about how the Mueller report is going to translate to Congress?
Yeah, it's such a great question. We don't know what form the report will take. Even if it is a minimal report, which says merely something along the lines of, I have filed the indictments that I intend to file, with nothing much further for Congress. By this point, we know that the president's campaign chair, his vice chair, his first national security advisor, two of his foreign policy advisors are guilty of criminal misconduct. And then beyond that, we have a documented, broad-based, purposeful effort by Russian military intelligence to interfere in the election of the United States. None of that is resolved by the charges that Mueller has filed. It raises as many questions as it answers. Michael Cohen's a great reminder that the investigations into the president have sprawled well beyond the Mueller probe. So Mueller himself was charged with looking at the possibility of collusion between the president's campaign in Russia and the nature of Russia's interference. But Cohen, although a critical witness in that probe, has also told New York prosecutors that the president of the United States directed his commission of serious campaign finance crimes. And that is still sort of an open and unresolved matter, although Cohen himself has pleaded guilty to that. So what Cohen says before Congress remains to be seen. But whatever he says, his appearance is a reminder that the sprawling criminal congressional investigations facing this presidency are not going any away. In fact, just this afternoon, we have word that they are expanding, that the district attorney in Manhattan is looking into Paul Manafort's financial crimes and may charge him separately.
And that would be largely something that would be to evade the pardon. If Donald Trump gave a pardon to Paul Manafort, this would stop it.
Right. In theory, New York has some of the strongest protections against double jeopardy of any state. So it remains to be seen whether or not it would hold up. But that seems to be the theory under which they're operating.
I wanted to say something about the way Congress is the Democrats in Congress are laying the groundwork and behaving here. We had this interesting article from Adam Schiff yesterday in the Washington Post where he just made a plea to Republican colleagues and asked them, you know, to kind of step up here and be independent. He said they must speak out. Your time for silent disagreement is over. This is going to require courage. I know people, the president's popular among your base, but it's time to show some loyalty to your country. What's he doing here?
Well, he chairs one of the rare islands of bipartisanship in most Congresses, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. It fell apart in the last Congress under the chairmanship of Devin Nunes. Now that Schiff has taken the gavel, he's clearly trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. He also faces a real challenge, as do other congressional Democrats. They believe that they're looking at allegations and evidence misconduct of the most serious kind on the part of the president. They're not quite sure how to go about persuading their Republican colleagues that this is the case, and they don't want their investigations to assume the taint of partisanship. So they're looking for allies. They're looking to build bridges across the aisle. It's going to be a difficult endeavor. But one thing we know from the impeachment of Richard Nixon is that what actually does it is not op-eds in the Washington Post. It's the assemblage of evidence. In that case, Republicans who talked about it at the time and later said that they were haunted by the thought that not acting against the president's clear and documented misconduct would amount to granting license to that misconduct, encouraging future presidents to behave in the same way. And that ultimately was the thought they couldn't countenance. And so if Schiff is really looking to build those bipartisan bridges, he's probably better served by continuing to put the evidence out there and confronting his Republican colleagues with it and encouraging them to think about the long-term effects of Congress not acting to rein in a president who is acting in this fashion.
And the Democrats are going to get an opportunity to start putting Republicans on the record as early as next week when they go with this national emergency declaration vote to reject what Donald Trump has done. Republicans will get a chance to go along if they think it's a bad idea. It seems like an opportunity to show some space between yourself and the president if you're a Republican.
Right, although not a whole lot of Republicans seem to be hankering for that opportunity right now. You know, the national emergency declaration, maybe we can put that in the bucket of things that presidents do that Congress may object to, but are not unique to this administration. There have been a lot of national emergency declarations. This one has a different legal foundation than many previous ones. But this is the process unfolding the way that Congress designed it, which is that the president issues the proclamation and then the House and the Senate have the opportunity to override it. This is a little bit different, perhaps, than some of the criminal allegations facing the president and his aides, which really have taken us somewhat outside of the normal process and led to the appointment of a special counsel.
I'm talking with Yoni Applebaum from The Atlantic. He wrote the impeach cover story for the March issue there, and we're talking about the impending Mueller report that is going to come sometime next week, according to reports. Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to hear about a film series where faith and film come together. Stay tuned for that. I want to explore a little more about Republican loyalty to Trump. One of the things that's been happening is Mr. McCabe from the FBI has been going around on talk shows and his book tour, and he is discussing how, you know, when they were behind closed doors with the Gang of Eight Congress people, and they were mentioning things like, we're going to investigate the president, nobody objected. No people hearing about the Republicans hearing about this thought it was okay. Is there something where Republicans behind closed doors will behave differently than Republicans out in public?
Well, I think that has been a persistent theme of this presidency. And in this specific case, the Republicans in the room have declined to comment because it was a Gang of Eight meeting, so they won't confirm or deny McCabe's allegations. But it would fit with a broader pattern of conduct in which many senior Republicans in this town are perfectly happy to express their displeasure with the president, their sense that he is unfit for the office that he holds behind closed doors, and then give speeches which are either avoiding that question or coming to different conclusions on the floor of their chambers. That is going to be a problem for any Democratic investigation of the president. They will need to get Republican elected officials in this town to line up their private remarks with their public conduct. And there are some very real incentives facing those Republicans, particularly the threat of a primary challenge, which militate against their doing that.
While Adam Schiff shows some, motivation to push Republicans, Nancy Pelosi doesn't seem to feel the same thing. I guess I've come to the conclusion that she wants to win in the next general election and doesn't really, in her gut, want impeachment. I don't know where that conclusion is coming from. I have no evidence. I don't talk to her. But does that sound about right to you?
Well, she's been clear in her public statements that she doesn't think the moment for impeachment is ripe yet. She's a little vaguer on whether or not it might be prior to 2020. The House right now is sort of proceeding with a three-pronged set of investigations, one under Schiff on the Intelligence Committee, under Jerry Nadler on Judiciary. Also that the House Oversight Committee is looking into a variety of alleged misconduct. You put those three together, and you can read it one of two ways. Either this is an effort by Democrats to start putting evidence into the public record, start gathering specifics, taking their own testimony from witnesses, not having to be reliant on leaks in the media from various prosecutors' office, but actually being able to drive the conversation themselves and to focus public attention on the acts that most concern them as they build slowly toward impeachment. Or it could be exactly what you suggest, which is a strategy of discrediting the president and then waiting for the next general election. It may even be the case that House Democratic leaders don't quite know themselves and are waiting to see exactly what they can turn up and document.
Is there anything that hasn't happened with the Mueller probe that you expected? Did you expect Donald Trump Jr. to get indicted? Was there something else going on that you felt would happen before the release of the report?
Well, I think we don't quite know what form that release will take. There are an unusual number of sealed indictments on the docket in the court where some of Mueller's indictments have been posted. We have no idea if those are tied to this investigation. So there may be more indictments still to come, even if the report itself is imminent. I think one of the things that is a little frustrating to me and many other observers is that Mueller had something of a dual mandate, both to investigate collusion, but also to investigate it within the context of Russia's efforts to undermine American democracy. He has done that superlatively well. In fact, he's done it well enough to have garnered praise from senior administration officials for his indictments of the Russians who are behind these acts. What we haven't had really is any kind of meaningful reform, any kind of safeguards coming into place to prevent the recurrence of such attacks. And indeed, there's reason to believe that some of these attacks were leveled again in 2018. So if I and others were hoping that a thorough and independent investigation could help break the partisan gridlock and galvanize some real efforts to protect American democracy and to harden it against these attempts at interference. So far, those hopes have been bitterly disappointed. It remains to be seen whether or not there is a report from the Mueller probe that leads that to change.
Do you think – I mean, it sounds like so far the whole thing, the Mueller report and investigations, they haven't changed people's minds. When you read the polls – 74% of Republicans say they believe Trump over Mueller. Is the report going to change those numbers? Is what is about to transpire going to be something that changes public opinion on this, do you think?
Well, certainly views of Mueller have become more partisan and more polarized in recent months as the president has really accelerated his attacks on Robert Mueller's independence and credibility. The numbers are a little hard to read. There are fewer Americans today who self-identify as Republicans than there were when Donald Trump was elected. And so although he enjoys the overwhelming support of those who still do, that has not been without a diminution in the support among Trump voters. Those are two different categories. So there are reasons for Donald Trump to look at these numbers and be concerned. Beyond that, what we know from past processes of a presidential investigation and indictment is that some of the president's supporters are likely to be wedded to him more closely than ever by the findings of this report. They'll see their champion under attack and grow more closed to contradictory information that they do not wish to accept. And at the same time, it's possible that would also coexist with a situation in which more and more Americans in the middle move decisively against the president. Those two things, which would seem to point in opposite directions, his hardest core supporters doubling down and the broad middle veering away, often can actually proceed in tandem. And that might be an outcome of a report.
Do you think Donald Trump's unusual candidacy and presidency have just changed the standard for impeachment, that the things are – the bar went so low and so many odd places that really people just don't know what to – how to – you know, he's just judged by a different standard.
Maybe you can ask me that again in 2 years. I look at this and look back at other past cases. Impeachment's always been a partisan question. It's fundamentally asking Congress, is this president fit to continue in office? And when the process starts, it's always the president's political opponents who are closest to saying no, and always his defenders who say, yes, he's perfectly fine. What happens once the process gets rolling is that Congress actually has to confront the evidence in specifics and detail. That's when minds start to change. And so I think it's premature to suggest that Donald Trump is an exception or different than past presidents. He looks a lot like some past presidents, particularly Andrew Johnson. It's more accurate to say that this is a Congress which, under Paul Ryan, totally abnegated its responsibilities to look into this president and his conduct. And under Speaker Pelosi, it hasn't gone much further. And until Congress actually gets down there and starts sifting through the evidence and confronting it, it's unlikely to make any progress on that.
Yoni Applebaum is a senior editor at The Atlantic. He wrote the impeach cover story for the March issue. Thanks a lot for joining us and talking about the possibilities of the Mueller report.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we'll talk about a film series where faith and film come together. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. Miloš Štelić is off this week, but we're going to talk about film, and we're going to talk about a film series where faith and film come together, and it is happening at Facets, and it's called the Religion in the Frame film series, and the force behind this is Gretchen Helfrich, former host of Odyssey here on WBEZ. Great to see you, Gretchen.
Great to see you, Jerome.
How are you?
I'm all right. I'm looking forward to the fest, which starts tonight. And can I jump right in with the plug?
Please.
Okay.
And explain the strategy here. You're working with the Martin Marty Center at the University of Chicago, and you guys are kind of brewing up something different.
That's right. So it's the Martin Marty Center, which has the subtitle of the Center for the Public Understanding of Religion. And then there's Facets Multimedia, which is all about film and better understanding of film. So you put the two together and you get a film festival where we have 7 films, each of which has some connection to religion, lots of different ways in which these films connect up with religion. But we're going to screen the films and then we're going to have a talk afterwards with someone, varies from night to night, about the themes in the film, about some take on the film. But, you know, it satisfies, I think, 2 urges. I think a lot of people want to talk more about religion. We live in a really religious society, or sometimes we do. And people love talking about film. Everybody likes going to the movies and then talking about the movie afterwards. And so we meet both of those needs in what I hope will be a really interesting and engaging way.
And this is the second time you've done it. I went last year and saw Groundhog Day, and then we talked with a Buddhist scholar about the reoccurrence of things that happen in Groundhog Day and in life.
So that conversation will be extended this year somewhat because we're going to see Slaughterhouse-Five on Tuesday, which you will recall as a film not about Buddhism, but rather about the bombing of Dresden. However, same thing, interesting conceptions of time and how our conceptions of time relate to suffering and our ability to process suffering. Super interesting. You should come to that one. You should come to all of them, Jerome.
I would like to come to all of them. I think your lineup this time is spectacular. You're starting right off the bat with Joan of Arc tonight. And I always encourage people to see silent film, and this one is the be-all and end-all.
Kind of. It is sort of the be-all and end-all of silent film. It's from 1928, French production. It is based on the actual transcripts of Joan of Arc's trials, and it's a incredibly compelling film. It's a little weird, I'll say, if you have, if you're not used to silent film. Well, even if you are used to silent film, this one's weird. So, you know, it's primarily the face of the actress playing Joan of Arc. So we're going to see that tonight, and we'll be talking with Françoise Melter from the University of Chicago, who's written about Joan of Arc and subjectivity and the many, many, many ways in which Joan of Arc challenged the structures of authority in her day and our day, and goes on and on. So I'm super excited about that one.
You've got First Reformed, the Ethan Hawke film that is directed by Paul Schrader, which was up for a bunch of awards and seems really super interesting. People might have heard of that one. There's others that people might not have heard of. There is an Iranian film, and I wanted to bring in Nari Safavi, who's standing by for the Weekend Passport segment, and he is familiar with the film Under the Moonlight. Great to see you, Nari.
Yeah, I'm sneaking in a little bit early because I love that film and got to meet once the director of it, Reza Amir Karimi. So,
tell us about it. What's this particular film about? Under the Moonlight doesn't sound very faithy.
Yeah, it is not very faithy, but it's sort
sounds
of
a little romantic, actually.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's actually romance as a part. Persian conception of romance has a lot to do with it too, and this is really more about a seminarian who starts to have doubts and decides that he wants to go out into the real world and figure out what the humanity is all about. And he crosses a bridge where a lot of homeless people kind of tend to hang out and starts to encounter a lot of the social problems, and decides ultimately that as he's about to graduate from the seminary and become a cleric, that he wants to not do that and basically dedicate himself to social service. And I think that Reza Amir Karimi, if I understand correctly his history, he himself was trying to become a seminarian and then decides to become a filmmaker instead. And he also is, this is sort of his homage to a Persian poem that's about, that kind of goes by poet Saadi, who says that the best way to worship God is to serve humanity. That it's not really about whether you're a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or a Hindu, but it's really about serving humanity. That's the best way to worship God. And I think this is his filmic interpretation of that poem.
Wow. Well, that's a pretty solid endorsement of the film, and very deep endorsement of the film. And that's with Scott Alexander. He's going to do the chit-chat after that film. Should be great.
We call it the engaging conversation, but if you want to call it chit-chat, Jerome, that's just fine. Yes, yeah, Scott Alexander, who is on the Marty Center board with me, and who his work focuses on Christian-Muslim, Catholic-Muslim specifically, relations. He chose this film, recommended it to me. I think it's a gem. I have to say, if I keep doing this festival, I will try to have an Iranian film every year, because there are so many good Iranian films and they need to be seen by more people. That's I want to be their film PR person.
And they've wrestled with faith in an interesting way. I mean, that is part of the deal now.
Exactly. Well, they deal with faith and politicize faith quite a bit, and that produces a lot of interesting, I would say, contrarian kind of a thinking about role of religion in the society. And a lot of times they get censored, but some of them actually do get made. It's amazing under that system.
So you've got some other great films that I didn't know anything about really in the series. Black Robe is one. It's a film by Bruce Beresford. He's an Australian filmmaker who people know from Driving Miss Daisy, and he had like some big Hollywood hits. But I knew nothing about Black Robe, but it seems really interesting.
So if it's okay, I'll let Rich Miller tell you about Black Robe. Rich Miller is going to be speaking after the film.
He'll be doing the chit-chat.
He'll be doing the chit-chat.
I'll be doing the chit-chat and the engaged conversation. So thanks, Jerome. Black Robe is the story of a 17th century young Jesuit missionary who embarks on a long journey across a fur trading route, accompanied by Algonquins, to missionize the Huron as winter sets in. And the Algonquins take him along this route, and they encounter a group of First Nations, the Montagna, who've never encountered the French and who themselves have a shaman who judges the missionary, Father Laforge, as the devil. as a demon. And so quickly you get the sense, you understand that this endeavor is not only facing serious natural challenges, but is walking into a huge culture conflict. And immediately, or pretty quickly, the priest's claims to knowing and presuming what is good for humanity are called into question. The Montagna convince the Algonquin to leave the missionary and his translator and a lover he's taken on. They leave them alone and join the Montagna on an expedition. A few of them come back to save the priest and are attacked by the Iroquois. And in a very brutal scene, you see another instance of a culture clash, although now it's multidimensional. The priest and those accompanying him are able to manage an escape and return to their trip to this mission deep in Quebec to evangelize the Huron. The translator and his lover leave the priest, and there he finds himself alone deep in New Quebec. And the priest who had staffed the mission is on his deathbed. He's able to convert the Huron there. As the film concludes, the viewers are told, and I don't want to give too much away, that disaster besets those who are converted. And so you have a film that raises the question of what is called the ethics of belief. What are religion's responsibilities to others? And to what extent can they presume to know what is good? So you have an ongoing struggle throughout the film of rival pictures of what is humanly good. And especially, I think, challenging for many viewers is the depiction of missionizing Catholicism that has at its root an intimate connection with death.
It's wow. not a light film. Let's yeah. be clear. This is a heavy, violent, brutal film.
You know, it's done in a kind of straight up colonial conflict terms, mm-hmm. but it translates to any kind of religious proselytizing, mm-hmm. doesn't it? It's when are you right to ram your beliefs down somebody's throat?
Well, yes. And what's especially interesting about this film is that the way in which the promise of salvation is offered is never itself innocent. The viewers are asked, is this a quid pro quo? Is this done delusionally? Is this done deceptively? And so the methods of proselytizing are depicted in ways that are troubling. But the other thing about the film that I would want to call to our attention is that the moral point of view of the film is never one that gives the viewer a safe space. No one is morally innocent. So at one level, proselytizing is troubled. So are those who are proselytized, right? There's a very complex moral scene that the film, as it were, portrays. And so as a viewer, you're denied any comfortable position if you think you're certain about what's right or wrong in this film. You are committing the same mistakes as those who are depicted in the film.
I would like to have some sympathy with the indigenous people who I know are going to get overrun in the end, but it sounds like the shaman is meets these people and decides they're the devil. That's pretty heavy. Statement. You're marking them for death, and you're doing the same violent
thing.
Yeah,
I think if I can jump in, sure. I think it's fair to say that the Native people who are depicted in this movie are not depicted as credulous or they're not in awe of this Catholic priest at all. I mean, for many of them, it's the idea of conversion is a transaction. They've got a full-fledged worldview. They don't need another religion. And they have a lot to say about it. And they think that the missionary is stupid and foolish and likely to die if they don't help him or likely to die by them or, you know, any number of possibilities. But these are absolutely – it's absolutely not a depiction of victimized Native people, in my opinion.
No. And they note several times he's wearing a black robe. Right. And so that's not just a casual gesture. They're marking him as symbolized in a certain way, that black robe suggesting that he's an agent of death and destruction. So you have that certainly going on. And again, no one's point of view is romanticized or valorized. But it is true that the First Nations are depicted as having a life that's perfectly fine. And enabling them to survive in these conditions.
All right. So, but is the lesson of the film that religions can't get along and are never going to get along?
Well, I think it depends.
I'll take that as a yes.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's any single takeaway. I mean, it certainly is a film that says religions that presume to know what's best for others, regardless of their religions, are opening the door for a tremendous amount of trouble and conflict.
But I mean, in their essence, all religions say they do know what's right for their others. That's their thing.
Well, I think you
know what's right for people, and you want to spread that.
I think if you wanted to end up at the end of this movie thinking, oh, well, you know, it's all just a different interpretation of the same thing and we can all get along. No, this film does not give you that. That's not an option. These worldviews don't match. The religions don't go together. And if they're going to be put together, it's going to be by some sort of jury rigging and not some sort of transcendent, we all see things from this higher perspective where we're all the same. I don't think this film's saying that at all.
It's not saying that. And it is about conflict and cultural difference. But it's also having the viewer ask, which of these religions actually has the human good correctly in view? And the missionizing Catholic in many ways operates on a very stark dualism between spiritual and earthly goods. And those he's evangelizing don't have that worldview and are actually doing quite fine with theirs. And so his dualistic kind of worldview is called into question in this film.
Richard Miller is professor of religious ethics at the University of Chicago Divinity School. He's the author of Friends and Other Strangers, Studies in Religion, Ethics, and Culture. Thanks a lot for joining us. And Black Robe is showing on Wednesday the 27th, and Richard is doing the chit-chat after that. He'll do a fine job, Gretchen.
And engaging conversation.
And Gretchen, we didn't mention there's a great – it sounds like a great South Korean film.
Secret Sunshine.
Secret Sunshine.
It's on the 28th, next Thursday.
Wow. So this is going to go one week every night. You're going to talk religion and film.
That's right.
22nd to the 28th, starting now.
Starting tonight, 7 p.m. at Facets.
Gretchen Helfrich, great to see you.
Great to see you, Jerome.
And Nari Safavi, we'll see you in a second on Weekend Passport here, and we'll talk about a fun band that's coming to town.
Sounds great. Yeah.
This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. It's time for Weekend Passport, where we let you know how to have an international good time on the weekend. Our global citizen friend Nari Safavi is here with recommendations on how to have a fun time this weekend. How are you, Nari?
Good day, Jerome. It's great to be back again.
Nari, what's your first recommendation? Where are we going?
We're going to Mexamerica, basically, in this segment. And the first thing I want to make sure people know about, there is an opening reception tonight at the National Museum of Mexican Art. And it's an opening reception of an artist called Rocío Caballero. And it seems like a very interesting artist who was born in Mexico, Mexico City, Distrito Federal in 1964. And these deals a lot with symbolism and symbolisms coming from Mexican culture, Mex-America culture, as adopted as his own language, a visual language. It's worthwhile checking it, and their opening reception is tonight.
It has to do with exploring representation of the female and male bodies and the symbolic currency that they're associated with. So it sounds good right
it
there.
It sounds very tantalizing.
It sounds
yes.
like we're on the right track. And, yeah. of course, the National Museum of Mexican Art is always a riot to go to.
Right.
What else is up now?
And we also have an interesting band that does a lot of very experimental music of Latin and pop and electronic from the Southern California, from South Los Angeles, called Sin Color, performing tonight in Chicago.
And we have the members of Sin Color here, Chrissy Regalado, and she's sitting right here in front of me. There's one half of the South LA-based duo. Nice to meet you.
Hello. Thank you for having us. Thank you.
David Aquino is here. He is the guitarist and multi-instrumentalist with Sin Color. Nice to have you. Thanks for joining us. Tell us a little about yourself, David. What's up?
So the Sin Color is a band from South LA. We started when we were in high school. Towards the end, Grisha was 16 and I was 17. we started writing music as soon as we got together, and then
And we've been playing ever since, working hard to get this project to everyone.
Now, your background, you trained as an opera singer?
Yes. Originally, I wanted to be an opera singer.
That's great. What stopped you, David?
Well, I was part of an all-girls choir, and when the director moved to Mexico, I was kind of lost. I didn't know what direction to take, and that's when I saw David again. Because I had met him before, but he came into my life again, and he offered to start this project and to compose songs and just to make music, and I was like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. Explain the name of your band, Sin Color.
Sin Color.
Without color.
Yes. The reason why we named it Sin Color is so that we don't get attached to a color, genre, or style. Everything or nothing.
So you can go back to opera if you want.
Yes, exactly. We've had a performance in LA at the Civic Center Studios where I began the set with two opera arias. I've sang Frühlingsthemen, and the second one was, my gosh, I forgot, but yes, I tried to add a little bit of everything so our audience could have a variety of options.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, South LA and just Southern California is an amazing melting pot of what's going on in America, and you seem to have influences from all kinds of sources coming at you. Tell us a little bit about your inspirations and your creative process. How do you approach doing a project, let's say?
Well, there's so many great bands in LA. Like, pretty much at any given time, any day of the week, any night, you could just go outside and go to a venue, and there's these so many amazing bands, local bands, independent groups, and they're all our peers. At the end of the day, we all hang out, we all know each other. So a lot of that rubs off on us. It rubs off on me personally because I see all so many different instrumentations. There's like cumbia, electronic music, DJs, merengue, pop. It's so mixed.
And the band has kind of expanded, and you've done kind of like things with cellists and things like that. And
yes. Yeah, we every once a year we have our we do a Sin Color orchestra performance. So that's us two backed by an orchestra. So the last one that we did was in December, the show that she was talking about, where she started off with the opera arias. We performed with a 16-piece orchestra that we gathered. We do all of this from scratch when it's our own shows. So in terms of promo, booking, the venues, gathering everything together, and just making it all possible. It's a big task. It's a huge task. Like you'd normally see like a huge team of people and huge productions running it, but this was just it's always done just by Chrissy and I, and then we have like our now we have like a nice little team of people that are working with us.
Well, we want to hear some of your music. Should we play a song? We've got three here, and I don't. Which one would you like to hear?
I think the most popular is Un Pensamiento. That one's on the list, right?
Yep. Yeah, Pensamiento.
Let's hear that. That's Sin Calor, and we have the members of Sin Calor with us here on Weekend Passport. They're in Chicago, and they're performing where tonight?
Tonight we'll be at Bar 10 Doors right here in Chicago.
Oh, terrific. And now that song was interesting. Do you have a philosophy with – I really enjoyed it – with electronics and how you want to blend things like accordions with electronics?
We don't have a philosophy or any kind of structure. It just all kind of happens organically with like whatever's around, whoever's around us. We have so many, we work with so many musicians throughout the time, and it's kind of like whatever's at our disposal.
Yeah, this is really interesting because it seems like you seem to be very sort of a self-sufficient duo over here. You can do things by yourselves and do more instrumental and more electronic things and just the two of you. Or you can expand and have collaborators and all go up to orchestral level. Is this a trend for musicians of your generations to kind of be this flexible in terms of how you approach the music?
Well, not that I know of. We just love music. Well, I love music. And when I first began this project with David, I told him that I wanted to do everything. Since I came from an all-girls choir, we were trained classically, and we would also get booked to perform like in museums or galleries or like a folklorico show where they had folklorico dancers and we had to sing with the mariachi. So whatever opportunity I had, like if they had a solo that was like a flamenco song, I would say, I can do it. Or a mariachi song, I would go on YouTube and I would find my favorite artists and imitate them. So because of that background, I think that's why our music takes many routes and directions.
Fascinating. Speaking of flamenco, I think... You said you may be able to do some a cappella performance for us.
Yeah, I can.
Por favor.
Okay. Fuego Fausto. Lo mismo que el fuego, Fausto, lo mismito es querer. Lo mismo que el fuego, Fausto, lo mismito es querer. Si te persigue, le llama y echa a correr. Malaya los negros que le cansaron. Amén.
Chrissy Arregalado. Yay.
Fascinating. Fascinating. I should to contextualize things. You guys are very jet lagged. You arrived from LA last night. And then you had to go to Appleton, Wisconsin without sleep to perform over there. And I guess it was very well received in the performance. And
Thank you.
Have a magnificent, mighty voice for a little woman that
Thank you.
So it's a really impressive with all the tiredness and everything too, that you can just belt it out like that.
Thank you so much.
And good mic technique, the way you moved away from the mic.
Absolutely.
Good idea.
Absolutely.
Our engineer nods in appreciation. Let's hear another song. You've got a couple more here. Unknown Kiss, Antes de Amare. What are they?
Unknown Kiss is one of the very few English songs that we have. That one's also really popular.
Yeah. Y esas lágrimas y el derretido del corazón. Y esas lágrimas y el derretido del corazón. Llanto que no me deja ver si en realidad tú no estás aquí. Llanto que no me deja ver si
That's a little bit of Unknown Kiss, and we're talking with Scene Couleur. It's David Aquino and Chrissy Regalado. And tell us about that song. What was that about?
Well, this song, I guess we'll hear Unknown Kiss next, but this song is called Antes de Amarte, and it's one of my favorite songs.
That one wasn't in English, was it?
Yeah. What I'm actually saying with the lyrics, I'm speaking of a love that created this ongoing river within the person. And once, like, that love wasn't reciprocated or unrequired love, it became ice. And once the person was conscious of the situation and willing to move on, as the heart started to pump again, the ice melted and became tears. So that's why I say, y estas lágrimas, hielo derretido del corazón.
Wonderful.
Good old heartbreak.
Tears
always
heartbreak.
Always good for a song.
Yeah.
I had a question about dealing with stereotypes. When you think about Spanish performing language bands coming from Los Angeles, Oso Motley, Los Lobos, and they had to deal with the issues of stereotypes and all that. Do you see yourself overcoming challenges because you perform in Spanish and just the bookings might not quite be there because you do some songs in Spanish?
Well, I feel like definitely music has given us a pass to everywhere. And we have, our audience is very diverse. We have from everywhere, and even though they don't understand the lyrics, they're still there. They feel it through the emotion. And like you said, stereotypes or stuff like that. Well, mm-hmm. We do have a lot of situations where we arrive and people look at us like, oh, who are these kids? Like, what are they going to do? And they always like just kind of like set
dismissive,
us aside.
Yeah.
But then once we start playing, and even if they walk away, there's been many times where we start a set with no one in front of us. Mm-hmm. And just because they heard, they start to come, like, from everywhere.
All of a sudden.
Yeah, thank God. Yeah.
Well, we liked hearing your music, and we're going to go out on
–
we're going to get to Unknown Kiss. We're going to play it out here.
Awesome.
And thanks very much for joining us, Scene Couleur. It's Chrissy Arregalado and David Aquino. They'll be at the 10 Doors Bar in University Village tonight.
Yes. Please come, everyone. Please. We really need your support.
And Nari Safavi, thanks for another good edition of Weekend Passport. And we will talk to you again next week. Monday on Worldview, we'll talk about Venezuela. Hope you can join us next week for Worldview. Worldview is produced by Steve Bynum and Julian Haida. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You've been listening to Worldview on WBEZ.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.